Hi, it's Tim Dre, president of the Illinois AFL-CIO. Thank you for listening to The Worker's Mic, supported by the Illinois AFL-CIO, fighting every day for working families. Visit ilafl-cio.org today. Enjoy the show, and remember, it's better in a union.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to The Worker's Mic right here on 720 WGN, powered by the National Coalition of Labor. I am Ken Edwards with the National Coalition of Labor. Sitting to my left, because we're in the old studio today, where it all began, is Phil Davidson, Mid-America Carpenters Regional Council. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy Groundhog Day.
Today's Groundhog Day.
That's right.
Absolutely. I love it. Maybe that's why we're in the old studio.
Yeah.
Because it's Groundhog Day.
We're going
Day.
Back in time.
So, unfortunately, on a sad note, there was a terrible aviation accident last week. And our thoughts go out to the families, everybody that lost their lives. There are union workers on that plane,
pilots,
you know, et cetera. I know there were some folks that from Olympic skating. Just a real tragedy. Somehow, by the way, the president blamed it on DEI, I think.
That's what he's assessing was the problem here, which is
outrageous.
Outrageous, yeah.
Come on, man. So, yeah, that's terrible. So, So that's the bad news. In the good news department, the Whole Foods workers in Philadelphia decided to join a union. First one in the United States to join a union. Right? And so massive, massive. Why? Once again, because Whole Foods outwardly portrays itself as very, very, you know, worker-friendly and teamwork and liberal and great values and organic, you know, chicken eggs and all this kind of stuff, right? And by the way, who owns Whole Foods?
That would be Amazon.
Oh, Amazon.
Yeah.
Well, then everything should go really smooth.
Of course.
Right?
They love unions.
Swimmingly. Yeah. No problem. Welcome, union.
And I don't want to hear that there's no money to pay union workers at Whole Foods when it's $14 for a dozen eggs there.
So funny you should say that.
It's crazy.
You're absolutely right. People are going crazy right now about the price of eggs.
Yeah.
But congratulations to the first Whole Foods organized location in Philly.
First of many, hopefully.
First of many is right. I got to imagine it's going to spread just like Starbucks. But, you know, they're in for a fight, especially with Amazon.
Absolutely.
And they only won by 30 votes. I think it was like 130 to 100 or something like that. So, you know, you got to flip 15 people and then, you know, you vote the union out. I mean, that's the old game. But at least they won. Hopefully they'll continue to organize within, get people on board. But we have a really cool guest, and his name is Eric Blanc, and he's a professor of labor at Rutgers University, which is in New Jersey, which just happens to be near Pennsylvania.
That's true.
Pretty like that. It's just geography, Phil. And
way to pull it all together.
And so he wrote a book, which I will, you know, politely call How to Union.
Yes.
So it's got a much longer title. Really got an interesting take on things that we've been talking about here on the air for a couple of years now. And he kind of sums it all. He like congeals it and gets it together. Because I really was thinking about this, Phil. Like, I should write a book called just How to Union, right? And just like come up with just 200 trillion ideas. Because there's no one right way to do it. But you've seen such an uptick in organizing, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, we're going to be back. We're going to talk
Eric
to him.
Did work for you.
I should get a piece of it.
Yeah. It was a mind meld, obviously.
All right, listen. We
talk to your lawyer.
Yeah, I talk to my lawyer. I am a lawyer. We'll be right back with more of The Worker's Mic right here on 720 WGN.
You're listening to The Worker's Mic, powered by the National Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Worker's Mic right here on 720 WGN. Ken, Phil. All right. So, as we stayed at the top of the hour, we are super stoked to have Eric Blanc on the show with us. Good morning, Eric.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on. First of all, you're the author of a book that I just got, which is how I found you, called We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big.
Yeah, that is the book.
Just came out?
It's going to be out in like a week.
Oh, I already got mine, but I think I pre-ordered it. So
you're just a very special person, so you got it early.
That's going on the Worker's Mic book club list for sure.
That's a good idea, Phil.
Yeah.
Required reading,
absolutely.
So, Eric, you are a professor. Tell us about yourself.
Yeah, so I come from a labor family. I was a high school teacher and a sort of union activist for 20 years in the Bay Area.
Oh, wow.
I got burnt out. Yeah, and then I got burnt out. I also worked on the dock, so I was an ILWU, longshore. And I ended up going to grad school, became a labor professor. So now I teach labor studies at Rutgers, but I'm still an organizer at heart. I'm really involved in I'm involved in my union, but I'm also involved in a project called EWOC, which is the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, which supports worker-led organizing across the country. So I wear a lot of different hats. I still have my sort of labor organizer hat, but I also have this academic scholarly type thing going on as well.
So you went from West Coast to East Coast?
Yeah.
Yeah, my family are mostly like Brooklyn Jews, so it was a bit of a return. They had gone out west briefly, but I'm back to the old stomping ground.
Welcome, member of the tribe. My family's Queens Jews.
Yeah,
I feel left out.
Phil, don't worry about it. All right, this is between us.
My last name is Davidson.
Yeah,
sort of counts.
Okay, fair enough.
So I'm glad to hear that you're not just an egghead. You're actually you're a warrior. You've been out in the streets and
working on the docks.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool. Did you like that?
Yeah, it was hard, though, because, when you start off, you get the worst shift.
Sure.
So for 2 years, I basically didn't sleep because I was doing the graveyard, every, a couple nights a week.
Yep.
So it was pretty hard. It was difficult. But I learned a lot, and I think it's a good experience.
Make good money?
Yeah, make good money. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
There's a reason why that's a good job and why it's a strong union.
Yeah, for sure. And so you're now a professor of labor studies at Rutgers?
Yeah, so Rutgers in Jersey. I teach students about the power of unions and try to recruit as many of them to the movement as we can.
Good for you.
Yeah, and there's not many colleges that offer labor studies programs anymore. Would you be able to speak to that, Eric?
Yeah, Rutgers is one of the few. There's a couple other, but Rutgers is
Illinois
really
has one. Yeah.
Yeah, University of Illinois, Bob Bruno, which is a good friend
exactly.
of our show.
There's a few out there, but, one of the interesting things is that labor studies was in decline for a long time, but in part because labor all of a sudden is really popular, particularly amongst young people. There's a growing demand. So we're seeing an increase in labor studies programs, like California, for instance, just set up like 10 new programs. So there is a trend in the right direction, at least now, as far as labor studies.
It's great to hear.
Yeah. I think we reported on this, Eric, that California passed some kind of rule or law that says that high school, at some point between 9 and 12, you have to have a week of
like
labor studies
seniors,
or something like that. Right?
Yeah.
Did you read about that?
Yeah, I heard about that. Yeah, I think it's great. It makes sense. Why shouldn't we learn about our own history?
Of course we should. I mean, look, we're being forced to learn about the Bible in school, right? So how about learning about labor for a change? Right?
We Are the Union is my Bible.
We Are the Union is your Bible.
That's right.
You know what the problem with your book, Eric, is? I'm sure you want to hear this.
I do not know.
It's really long.
Too many words?
It's just a lot of words. Yeah. Not a ton of pictures.
Yeah, I need some more pictures.
Yeah. Is there any way you could send a Reader's Digest version?
We'll do it. We'll give you the audio book, but I'll draw you. I'll draw you a sort of very rudimentary version. I'm a bad artist, though. But
how about labor?
If you demand it,
how about labor for dummies? I swear to God, Eric, I'm not kidding about this. I was going to try and write a book, and when I say book, I mean maybe
pamphlet?
Five pages, a pamphlet, just called "How to Union."
There you go.
And which I think, of course, Eric has beat me to the punch. So I just got this book the other day, and it's really, really. It's just awesome. You have a unique perspective on how the labor movement could move forward. So it's not really a history book. This is how we move forward. And obviously I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I'm going to. But I started perusing it, and I have a lot of questions for you. But before we get to some of the meat and potatoes of the book, I want you to talk about what just happened with the National Labor Relations Board. So we had, what's her name, Jennifer
Abruzzo,
who was the general counsel. And, that's an at-will position, right? When a change in administration comes, they usually change general counsels, right? Eric, am I right about that?
Yeah, that's the norm.
Yep. And so that was not unexpected. Trump fired her, has not replaced her, but fired her. But here's what's really funky.
But then he also got rid of Gwen Wilcox.
Yeah, there was a board member.
Yeah.
Okay, a board member. And how long are those appointments? 6 years?
I think it's, 5 or 6. But, her term lasted until August 2028. That's the thing. So she was, Congress decides that, not the president. Yeah, she was supposed to stay until 2028. The president doesn't actually have the power to remove her.
Okay, so the removal was illegal, correct?
That's correct.
And those terms are staggered specifically for that reason. So when there's a switch in power in the president's office, you can't just get rid of someone who you don't like, right?
Yeah.
That was why it was designed that way.
Well, look, there was a vacancy. We talked about this a couple weeks ago. There was a vacancy and, you know, two Dems flipped and they didn't fill the vacancy, or reappoint, I should say.
Yeah.
And so that vacancy is now going to go to the Republicans, right? To make matters worse, that Trump just came out and decided that he could fire a board member that is appointed by Congress.
Yeah.
And so Eric, what happens from here?
So there's a lot of different things going on. The first thing we're saying is that all of the evidence we have so far strongly suggests that Trump, contrary to the hopes of some people in the labor world, has not proven to be more pro-union than other Republican administrations, but in fact is significantly more anti-union, that this is an unprecedented step to potentially kneecap the National Labor Relations Board, which, you know, we depend on to a significant extent for the right to unionize. So what this attack is both sort of on behalf of the employer class, but it is also part of Trump's broader power grab. It wasn't just the NLRB. Sort of across the board, he's been pushing the legal boundaries, breaking the rules, sort of actually consciously breaking the law in order to push it to some of these conflicts to the Supreme Court. And he did that in a lot of different agencies, including the NLRB. And what this means, though, in the immediate, which is different than some of these other agencies, is that on a national level, the NLRB can't function right now because it doesn't have a quorum. There's
okay.
not, you need at least three people. You need at least three people.
Right.
Who are sort of on the five-person board for it to make any decisions. And currently, there's nobody. So we'll see what happens. But for the time being, on a national level, there's paralysis.
So this happened, I forget when, but there was not a quorum on the board, and the board passed a bunch of decisions, and they were all overturned because there was not a quorum. Correct?
Yeah, a few years ago that happened.
And so they learned their lesson, and now there has to be a quorum.
And the new quorum will eventually be all Republican, right?
Well, so it is now.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. That's what he's doing.
I mean, that's the goal.
There's always been
but
the balance
there. You didn't really need that because he was about to be able to appoint, you know, whatever it was, two more so he'd have a Republican majority.
Yeah, you don't
anyway.
Have the majority, right. But now there's going to be no dissenting voice. It's just
I would assume
yeah.
so. So
the question, which we really don't know, and we're only going to find out over the next weeks and months, is whether Trump is actually just trying to paralyze the board, period, or whether this is just sort of a short-term move to deprive the Democrats of any pro-union forces on the NLRB and then eventually he'll appoint other people. You know, it's unclear. We don't know what it's going to look like. We do know that this move is part of a sort of legal offensive to push the president's powers to the Supreme Court so that the president could have essentially direct oversight to fire at will anybody who's on the board. So that is one possibility, but it's really sort of uncharted territory as far as what is going to happen to the board in the meantime.
I mean, I think you're right. It's part of his overall strategy, and he was not shy about saying this. He wanted to destroy the administrative state, right?
Yep.
Deregulate. That's what he's doing. And, you know, he's certainly making good on that promise. Whether he can or can't, you know, is going to be held to the courts, I guess, and to the people, and see if the rule of law holds. But,
right.
you know, there was a case, I think, Eric, from like 1935 that says you could remove a board member, but it has to be for, you know, for just cause, basically.
For
a good reason.
I think it's like malfeasance, I think is the word, yeah.
Malfeasance, there you go. And so this board member certainly wasn't guilty of any malfeasance, and I don't think they accused her of any malfeasance. I think they just said,
no.
You're fired, and end of discussion, pack your bags and go. And now she's got to go to court to try and get her board position back, or Congress has to do something. But if Congress looks the other way, right, even though this is their purview and their appointee, then they have ceded their power to the president. And that is, I think, what you're saying, Eric, is like that's what his goal is, right, to try and just grab power.
Or just steamroll.
And that's what he's doing, you know. And so, look, we're a week or two into his presidency, and we're going to start to drill down on what he's doing that's, you know, good, bad, or indifferent for labor. But this right here strikes at the heart of labor. Now, here's my question for you, Eric. The labor board just sort of left, if you will, with a Biden administration and a bunch of decisions that overturned various precedent and made it better for unions, no more captive audience meetings, et cetera. So by kneecapping the board, doesn't that leave all of those decisions in place today as they sit?
Yes. The basic dynamic is that those laws and decisions are on the books. The tricky thing is that on a national level, the enforcement mechanism has gone away. So on a local level, and we can talk about this more, on a local level, you don't need quorum. So the fact that on a national level there isn't quorum, that isn't going to prevent a lot of the basic functions of NLRB, which are from the local offices. So like running a union election,
sure,
filing for unfair labor practice. But some of the high-level decisions for the time being are still on the books. But they could be appealed, and it's not actually clear who would enforce them if the bosses decide that they're just going to ignore them, which they often do.
Wait a second. Are you saying that employers ignore the law? Hold on a second. That's breaking news.
But there's so many punishments for them if they do.
Oh, wait a second. No, there's not.
Oh,
yeah. No, they have to put up a posting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ideally.
Yeah. So, you know, so the Amazons of the world and Chipotle and Trader Joe's, and I mean Trader with a T, and here in Chicago, Eric, there's a hot dog stand called Portillo's. They've joined in the fight,
yeah,
to deem the NLRB unconstitutional.
Yeah.
So what do you think about that? I'm sure you've been following that.
Yeah, so this is, again, a really big deal. It's part of the offensive, essentially, of the employer class to take away what little rights remain for the union movement. And we have seen that despite the weak enforcement mechanisms, having a good pro-union NLRB under the Biden administration did make a big difference. You know, part of the reason we've seen this uptick in union struggles was that the NLRB weighed in on these issues, and it made it easier for workers to fight back against the bosses. So it's not surprising that the Elon Musks of the world, that the Jeff Bezos of the world would like to see the NLRB gone. What exactly will happen from these lawsuits is unclear. There's different lawsuits. It's unclear whether the result would be to just completely get rid of the NLRB and the law that underpins it, which is the NLRA, or whether it would be something maybe more narrow, which would allow essentially Trump to have done what he did, which is to assert his ability to essentially fire board members at will. If it's that narrow, frankly, it won't be that big of a difference. You know, if you have a majority, the Republicans or the Democrats, whoever, they're still going to decide. So it doesn't actually matter that much whether you have dissenting voices in the grand scheme of things. What would be the real sort of huge development would be if they really significantly undermine or get rid of the NLRB, period.
And if they do, and we've talked about this, and I'm going to say it again, be careful what you ask for. You know, the employer class wants the NLRA. It wasn't given to the workers. It was
right.
Put in place to promote labor peace because there were all these strikes. It
yeah.
was affecting commerce. It was put in place for employers. End of discussion.
Yeah.
All right. They say it's like, oh, a union worker thing, you know, or a worker pro, a pro-worker act. That's fine. Sure. It helps workers. But that wasn't the intent. The intent was to stop all the wildcat strikes.
Yeah.
Stop
yeah.
the disruption of commerce. So,
NLRB or no NLRB, Amazon workers are still going to be upset and still go on strike.
I want to talk about that.
Yeah.
So, hey, Eric, can you stick around for one more segment?
Yeah.
All right, listen, we got to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be right back talking more with Eric Blanc, the author of We Are the Union, and the current status of NLRB and a bunch of other questions. So, more of the Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN.
You're listening to The Workers' Mic, powered by the National Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN, powered by the National Coalition of Labor. We still have Eric Blanc with us, the author of We Are the Union. Eric, thanks for sticking around. I'm going to rattle off some concepts, questions, et cetera, to you right now. You ready?
Rapid fire.
Rapid fire.
Good.
All right. Here in Chicagoland, there's a lot of unions that practice what we call board avoidance. We don't like the NLRB. right? The NLRB will come after us and join us from picketing, you know, striking, you know, accuse us of secondary boycotts, you know, whatever it is. We literally try and avoid the NLRB like a plague. There are some here that are, you know, kind of saying, I don't care if the board goes away. What do you say to that?
I think it depends which sector you're in. The big story is that labor has power no matter what the law says. The labor movement existed before the NLRB. It's going to exist after if it goes away.
Excellent.
So I think you're right that our power doesn't depend on the law. That being said, certain workers do benefit more than others. So if you're in the skilled trades, you have a lot of leverage just by your position in the market that other workers, if you're like a Starbucks worker, don't necessarily have.
Yep.
So I think particularly for lower-waged workers who are more easily replaced, the NLRB does play a more important function. So it does depend where you're at. But if it goes away, they're not going to stop organizing.
Very good. Okay, good. I like to hear that, and that's a good answer. Do you think that unions have legislated themselves out of existence? And here's why, right? I organized for, you know, whatever, 25 years. I don't need a union because I have the, and just fill in the blank, the FMLA, wage and hour, OSHA, blah, 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 right? And we, labor, have pushed for those laws. Have we legislated ourselves out of, you know, not existence, but a need for us? What do you say to that?
No, I don't think that's the case because the reality is that living standards for working people have been declining for 40 years. And so even with this legislation in place, the actual day-to-day lives of working people are getting worse because they don't have unions. And without a union, you're not going to have a voice at the job. You're not going to have a mechanism through which you make the employers pay you your fair share. Even when these sort of extra benefits exist, you still need a union.
Very good. Perfect.
Not to mention some of those workplace protections are being rolled back.
Child labor.
As we've seen with OSHA, as we've seen with, you know.
Well, they're all going to be gone. There's going to be no more OSHA.
I know. You know? So, yeah, what's currently in place might not be existent in 2 years.
Okay. So, good. I like that answer. And so, you know, we talked at the top of the hour, Phil, about the very first Whole Foods organizing, and Whole Foods is owned by Amazon, obviously, and they organized in Philly.
In Philly, right.
And that's a big deal because it's like, once again, another shot across the bow at Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Eric, is the future of that organizing drive? Does that spread around the country now or
to
what?
To me, the win this Monday at Whole Foods was just historic. This is one of the biggest wins we've seen for the labor movement in recent years because it's going to be like Amazon as far as the warehouses. This is an Amazon company, but Whole Foods is also just a really ripe target for organizing.
Agreed.
Its brand, it's sort of progressive,
agreed,
blah, 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 is just so in contradiction with its actual practices. And you have a lot of young workers, people like who might have worked at Starbucks. That kind of demographic of young, maybe more progressive workers are also working at these stores. So I think it could spread. I've already did the interview with one of the worker leaders in Philly, and they're saying that every day they're getting more requests for help from stores all across the country reaching out over Instagram and saying, how can we do what you did?
It's fantastic.
Right on.
So keep going down that road for a second, because you talk in your book about Starbucks, and you know, they potentially had a breakthrough, but then, of course, they changed CEOs, and that I think that breakthrough got put the brakes on. The brakes on a breakthrough.
Yes.
Do you have to have a plan in place, Eric, when you're organizing to get to that first contract? Because like you say in your book, and we've all said this, the organizing is the easy part. Getting your first contract is the hard part.
Yeah, you need a plan, but what you need most of all is power, right? Because you can have a good plan, and if you don't have the power to back that up, then you're not going to get a first contract. So when it comes down to getting a first contract, just the reality is oftentimes it takes a long time if you're going to bring a massive corporation to the table because you just need an incredible amount of power. So I am actually, I push back against this idea when people say, oh, they haven't won a contract yet at Starbucks or Amazon. You know how long it took to win a first contract at Ford, GM in the 30s? They were organizing those companies for 30 years because it's just massive companies. It takes a long time and takes a lot of power building to do that. So I think from that perspective, they're doing really well that they've gotten this far against these companies, and I would expect them to be able to win eventually. But yeah, it's going to take a lot more effort.
So you are the glass half full in that regard, and I like that. That's good. That makes sense, right? Because you're right. Ford, you know, they hated the fact that they went union.
Yeah.
Right? And before there was even an LRB, you had the Pinkertons, and you had people dying.
Yeah.
Right? Actual people dying for this stuff. And so
I think Ford still might not be too thrilled about having unions.
You think so? Well, I can tell you who's not thrilled is Amazon.
Oh, gosh, no.
But here, so with no NLRB, right, and with what I would absolutely consider an anti-worker administration, and then I would also say that there's an anti-worker Supreme Court, how do you get from here to there, Eric? Like, do you just – is it pure – economic impact? Is it pure power struggle? Is it pure, you know, hurting them in their pocketbook? How do you get there?
It's a resistance.
Well, look, there's all sorts of factors that are pushing, actually, for labor growth. There's all sorts of reasons why the labor movement still actually has a lot of potential for significant growth over the coming years, even with Trump in power. So, one, the labor market is still very tight. That gives a lot of workers leverage, right? Because
yes.
They're not worried about getting fired to the same extent, or you think you can get another job, you're going to be more willing to fight back. But not just that, there's just an overall sentiment of anger at the corporate class, and that there was high expectations that Trump might be able to resolve some of these sort of grievances that working people all across the country have who are struggling to survive. And he's not going to be able to deliver that, and only the union movement is going to be able to deliver. So the kind of centrality of working class concerns is acknowledged by everybody, and that creates a possibility for the labor movement to take its place as the rightful champion of all working class Americans and say, we are the force that's going to win economic dignity for everybody. So I think even with Trump in power and even some of these sort of headwinds, there's all sorts of potentiality for growth. The question is whether the labor movement is going to start investing seriously in new organizing and in growth, because most unions, frankly, are very narrow focused and are not really investing in bringing new members to the extent that they should.
Excellent. Okay, so you bring us to the next topic. So there needs to be a change, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. There needs to be a bit of a sea change, right, in terms of union power. So the National Coalition of Labor, I think, is one very small example of unions getting together, leveraging the economy to scale, and doing something together, right? It hasn't existed before. It exists now. You sent out an email blast because we subscribe to it, and you talked about the AFL's kind of mamby-pamby response to the National Labor Relations Board issue. Talk about that.
Yeah, the response to the AFL was not wrong. They said this is bad that Trump is firing the Gwen Wilcox. But the problem was that it didn't give any perspective of fighting. And if anything, it made it seem like you couldn't fight now, that the NLRB is already gone, which isn't true. And it didn't give any perspective for workers to know what to do. And so I do think the sort of responsibility of leadership at this moment, where people are really looking for answers, is to say, not only can you fight, but you can fight and win, and we're going to be there with you when you do that. And so this kind of wait-and-see defensive mode, I think, is not going to be up to the moment we're in.
I agree with you. Best defense is offense.
Yeah.
We need to be on the offense. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. The AFL-CIO should be taking all of its money, all of it, and put it in an organization. The AFL-CIO, in my humble opinion, not the state's AFL, by the way, they're fantastic. Here in Illinois, we have one of the best AFLs around. They helped us push. We got our first workers' rights amendment, which I don't know if you know this, Eric. It puts in our Constitution the right
enshrined
to collectively bargain. And so no right to work.
Yep.
And so that was the first one in the United States. That was pushed massively by the Illinois AFL-CIO. So on state level, I think they do fantastic. On a national level,
ban captive audiences as well.
Ban captive audiences. But on the national level, they don't. And I think there's a vacuum in the leadership. I think they're not out in front. You know, when we had our workers' rights amendment, there was nothing from the national. And so they need to rise to the occasion of, like, they're going to gut the labor board, we're going to fight, we're going to do this, and here's our 10-point plan to do it. Or if you need resources, here's a bunch of free lawyers, or here's a bunch of free organizing training, et cetera, et cetera. Like, I think they need to do more.
Yeah, 100%. I would say I agree with you completely, because the reality is, if we're only fighting on the terrain that Trump and the Republicans choose, if we're just in defensive battles
right
around their issues,
yep,
that means we're not going to be fighting as much around our issues, you know,
yep,
questions of economic dignity, inequality. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is, entirely agree, there needs to be an offensive, sort of ambitious mode. It isn't just the AFL-CIO. I would argue it's actually, first and foremost, the national union leadership and local union leadership. Because the AFL-CIO, frankly, doesn't have that much power or resources. It can give a signal,
sure,
but it's not like even if they snap their fingers, everyone's going to go in marching orders. So there's a question of broader leadership responsibility and talking about breaking from, frankly, a strategy that has gotten us into this crisis of just narrowly focused organizing, the servicing existing members, and then hoping that the Democrats at some point down the future are going to turn things around for us. Like, that is what's gotten to this crisis, that it has to be a rethinking given the situation we're in.
And that's what your book talks about, that's that, right? Yeah. Worker to worker organizing, revitalizing the labor movement, different ideas, different strategies, things like that. I agree with you, you know, wholeheartedly. I think it is up to leaders to think outside the box, to do things differently. If you constantly look, we've been waiting for the Democrats to pass the PRO Act for, before that it was, you know, the Employee Free Choice Act or whatever. I mean, we've been waiting for, you know, for forever, yeah. Right? It didn't happen. It's not going to happen. So we need to do it ourselves. And I think,
And I think the population is ready for it. I mean, it's hard to organize when things are going well, when people have good jobs, when they have benefits, when they're able to pay their rent and take care of their families. But as we know, a lot of people are struggling. So this is, man,
there's
a right population that wants to be organized and wants better jobs. And this is what we can offer.
This is what labor can offer.
Yes.
But labor has to step up to the plate and offer it.
Yes.
You say in your book that labor needs to devote more resources to organizing, more money to organizing, get out from under the model of having an organizer just show up at a shop. You know, you talk in depth about how that works. And it's not an easy task, right? You were an organizer. I was an organizer. It's certainly, it ain't easy. But if you had worker-to-worker organizing, right, then it kind of changes the dynamic of it. You know, what do you think about that? Explain that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, part of the dynamic we have right now is that there is a real momentum of the labor movement. We've seen these drives spread across the country. Some of them were in first contracts already. Some of them are still fighting. But there has been, you know, hundreds of thousands of workers have won unions over the last 2 or 3 years, and it's been driven in large part by this bottom-up grassroots organizing and disproportionately and primarily young workers. You know, it really is being led by young workers. And I think the labor movement has a bit of a generation gap where they don't realize how much sort of potential there is to let these young workers all across the board, all different regions, different backgrounds, run with things and say, yeah, we're going to take the lead. We're gonna fight, and we're going to train our coworkers. We're going to do a lot of the things that in the past it was assumed that a full-time staffer had to do, right? It was just not going to happen if you don't have a full-timer working on it. Well, it turns out a lot of these young workers are taking the lead and say, yeah, I'm happy to go, you know, door knock and talk to my coworkers. I'm happy to go train my coworkers. I want to have ownership over this process. And I think that is the way forward, but you're going to need unions to really lean into that model.
I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, it's like, look, like you said, Phil, well, you got nothing left. You got nothing left to lose.
Yeah.
It's not like these people at Starbucks and Amazon and, you know, these major corporations are living high on the hog. They're still working two jobs.
Yeah.
Three jobs. The spouse has to work, right? They're still living paycheck to paycheck. And while the companies are making profits that, you know, are never been seen before.
Rockets to Mars, yes.
We're going to Mars,
yeah.
You know. So there's become such a wage disparity. There's become such a concentration of wealth at the top.
It's getting worse.
And you're seeing it. Look, you put on social media and you just type in the word picket, you'll see pickets all around the country. You'll see scabby all around the country, right? You'll see strikes all around the country. And, you know, I just keep going back to this. You know, once again, employer class, be careful what you ask for. You get rid of the NLRB, you know, continue to treat people like dogs. They're going to turn into wolves and, you know, they're going to form the wolf pack and, you know, come after them. So, I don't know. I think the time is right. And I agree with you. I don't think it matters who is in power. Right, there's an upswing in worker momentum right now, and we need to continue to take advantage of it. But we can't keep doing the same thing over and over. What's the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and expecting different results, right? So we have to change our model. We have to try different things. We have to bend the rules. You know, we just have to whatever works, right? Just like you said, Eric, what works for the building trades doesn't work for the SEIU, right? So where do you think this leaves us, Eric? What do you think the give us a prognostication for 2025?
I mean, I think it depends on what people do. It depends on what people listening to this show do. Are you, if you're not in a union already, are you going to organize a union at your work? If you are in a union, are you going to push so that union is putting more resources towards bringing in new members? You know, it's very hard to predict because we don't know what Trump's going to do, but also we don't know what the union movement's going to do. We don't know what workers do. All I can say, though, is that if rank and file organizers and workers and sort of more militant union leadership take a bold initiative, the moment is ripe for that to catch. And so I think we need to have confidence that when we act in a bold way, workers will respond. We've seen that. So you need to have confidence in the ability of people to fight back, and you need to give the signal that you're willing to go along with that fight.
Excellent. Excellent. I love to hear that. And it's good to hear an aggressive approach on this stuff. And look, I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. You know, once again.
Yeah, great ideas. Yeah, thank you, Eric. Yeah.
And I'm going to read your book from cover to cover. You know, one last thing, Eric. In your book, there's a picture of a Starbucks cup, and it says Union Yes. And my Starbucks that I'm looking at, I go to my Union Starbucks here, and I put Union Yes as my name. I thought I made that up. There's a picture in your book about it.
Like, kindred spirits.
Yeah, who knew?
Good. It was a very good idea.
Yeah.
Maybe your spirit lived on nationally.
Eric, I don't have a single original idea.
What are you talking about? You're the idea, man.
Yeah. All right. So Eric Blanc, right, professor of labor, Rutgers University in beautiful New Jersey. And his book is We Are the Union, How Worker to Worker Organizing and Revitalizing Labor and Win Big. You should go out and get it. Read it. It's important. It's really important. Labor leaders listening, working class people listening, union members listening, people that want to be in union, like you said, you know, let's start. And there's plenty of resources out there, but you're right. Let's push the unions to, you know, step up and step up big. Eric, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. We'll be right back with more of The Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN.
You're listening to The Workers' Mic, powered by the National Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Workers' Mic, 720 WGN, Chicago, soon to be nationwide.
Here we go.
That's our goal, 2025.
Syndication.
By the way, if you know how to do that, let us know.
Yeah.
Because we gotta make that happen. Anyway, that was really interesting. I could talk to this guy for a very long time. He's got a different take on things. I would encourage everybody, go check out this guy's book. It is smart. I've
and
only
you
read a bit of
with,
it.
But with some optimism, because he talks about how the millennials and Gen Z are going to save the labor movement because they are so committed and militant about it, and they're not messing around, and as he calls them, labor-pilled. So
yeah,
we got a bright future with the young people.
And he's good. Yeah, he really does have this like glass half full perspective, which I think is refreshing. You need it. And he's not afraid to call people out or organizations out and tell them to, you know, get with the program, like get aggressive. So
yeah, I mean, because we did see there's some numbers that came out that said, you know, union membership is down right now. We lost some from the previous year. So
but if
that being the case,
yeah,
what are we doing to fix it? And he's got some great ideas.
We have to fix it.
Yeah.
And we can't continue to rely on government to fix it for us. End of discussion.
Yeah.
It's got to be, you know, upswell from the bottom, you know, just rising to the top.
Member to member.
Right?
Worker to worker.
Worker to worker, member to member, union to union. Maybe unions start getting together, you know, doing things like the National Building Trades are doing. Laborers are going, hey, we want another, you know, we want a million. So laborers have a program. I forget what it is, but they either want to get to a million or have a million new members or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Teamsters are organizing, Amazon.
Same
like,
way.
Like taking some big ticket to go like, all right, let's flex our muscles finally,
yeah.
Right?
Taking big swings.
And I'll tell you another thing. Stop just throwing money at politicians.
Yeah.
We spend so much money on politics. I forget what the number is. If I read it to you, and I'll look it up, it's astounding how much money labor gives to politicians. And for the most part, they give it to Dems. And Dems continue to get their clock cleaned. Well, half our membership is voting Republican plus. So here in Illinois, like, we play both sides of the aisle.
Right.
I think a lot of smart unions do. But on a national level, you know, the AFL-CIO nationally, you know, it all goes to the Dems. And it hasn't really served us. So if we took all that money and we put it into organizing, maybe that would help.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. There's no one right answer. Suppose you made organizing, you monetized it.
Love it.
You do?
It's a great idea.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Because people like are incentive. Look, I've always like kind of joked, but not really. Like I haven't really encountered a problem that money doesn't resolve. And so if you said, oh, you know what, we're going to pay you 10 cents a card that you get signed. And if you bring on, you know, 20,000 new members, we're going to give you a piece of the dues for the first 5 years or something like that. Whatever. Right. I think it would incentivize a whole
That's what
new
motivates
slew.
Human behavior.
It's sales.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. You're either buying or selling no matter what you do.
That's right.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's one of my ideas. I think I'm going to, being that Eric wrote my book for me, I'm going to write another book called pay to play, or I don't know, something like that.
I'm in.
All right,
can I get
thank
a piece?
You.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah,
good.
You can, yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, you'd be my first paid organizer.
All right, good.
Kick ass. All right, listen, thanks for WGN. Thanks for the listeners. Thanks for the sponsors. Thanks for the continued support and comments. We really appreciate it. Thanks for Punxsutawney Phil. Is that the groundhog?
Phil Connors?
All right, listen, we'll be back next week with more of The Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN.
The preceding episode of The Workers' Mic was powered by the National Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premis Health, and Voya Financial. For additional information and podcasts of The Workers' Mic, visit WGNradio.com.